The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chha. In this special edition of the podcast, I'm here with Russell Foster, a neuroscientist at Oxford University and an expert in circadian rhythms. He's here to explain why snoozing certainly isn't losing. We ask, in our quest for the 24/7 society, can we really fool our biological clocks, which have been honed over millions of years of evolution? We started with the basics. I asked Russell what a circadian rhythm actually is.
Well, we all have this sort of internal representation of a day, you know, whereby physiology and behaviour is constantly being adjusted by an internal clock to fine-tune physiology and behaviour to the varying demands of activity and rest. So, for example, in anticipation of dawn, blood pressure, metabolic rate and a whole range of hormones will start to rise in anticipation of activity. And at the same way, just before we go to bed, hormonal systems, core body temperature will start to drop. And the really critical thing to appreciate is that if you or I went to a dim, dark cave, constant light, constant temperature, then you'd still see patterns of near 24 hours. Now, it's not exactly 24 hours. So the body clock in humans tends to be a little bit longer. And so what you need to do every cycle, of course, is set a sort of somewhat longer clock to exactly 24 hours. And of course, we'll get to those interesting resetting mechanisms in a moment. But what you've got is this internal representation of a day, which adjusts, you know, physiology, which is extremely dynamic to the varying demands of activity and rest.
And this is something that's evolved, obviously, over several millions of years. For what purpose? I mean, why do we need to do all of this?
It's probably very ancient. And we assume that very early life had some sort of timing device so that it could compartmentalize aspects of cell biology to a pretty ferocious early world. So before there was any oxygen, there was no ozone layer. And so life would have been bombarded by ultraviolet light. And so one idea is that a clock evolved to actually move those cellular processes out of the day, avoiding UV light, where they would have been subject to considerable damage. And basically you had to sort of make sure your DNA in particular was not going to be smashed apart by exposure to ultraviolet light. And so the idea is that, for example, expression of you know, cellular systems would actually move out of the light phase and into the dark phase.
And this is something conserved across all species, is it?
We have a pretty good understanding of the molecular basis of the clock. So at its core, you have a gene which is producing a message. The message is then translated into a protein, and that protein will then enter the nucleus and turn off its own expression. So essentially, you've got a switch. And we now know that there are probably 12 to 14 critical genes in their protein products, which all assemble to form this molecular clock. Now, what's turned out to be, I think, truly extraordinary is that the basic building blocks of the clock in you or I are broadly conserved across the whole of the animal world. So in a fruit fly, Drosophila, they have, broadly speaking, the same genes and the same proteins to build their clock. So species separated by 450 million years or so of evolutionary divergence are still building their clocks in broadly the same way. If we jump to the plants or the fungi, they have different genes in the construction of their clock. But again, the feedback mechanism seems to be broadly conserved. Again, it's this molecular loop that seems to be at the core of the molecular clock.
And in what parts of the brains are involved? In us, for example, are there specific parts of the brain that do the switching on and off, or where these genes are active?
The critical master body clock for the mammalian systems, in us, for example, is an area of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nuclei. And you can imagine where it is, because as the optic nerves go into the brain, they fuse. And right above that is an area called the hypothalamus. And they sit at that, just above where the optic nerves fuse, the optic chiasm, and they sit there. It was established fairly early on in the last century, in 1920s, 30s, that if the anterior hypothalamus is destroyed, in an animal, for example, then 24-hour rhythms are lost. But the precise location of this clock came in the early 1970s, where people identified this structure, the suprachiasmatic nuclei, and used very fine lesions and showed that when this error is gone, then 24-hour rhythmicity was also lost. Now, we know that the SCN, the suprachiasmatic nuclei, consists of around about 20,000 cells in a mouse, 50,000 in us. And each of those individual cells is capable of generating a circadian rhythm, a 24-hour oscillation. So what that told us is that the clock, the master clock, isn't the product of cell-cell interactions. It's not a network property, but it's actually an individual cellular property. And we're going back to that sort of molecular feedback loop. And so the original conception was that this SCN essentially forces, drives 24-hour rhythmicity on the rest of the body. But what became clear in the 1990s, a chap called Uli Schibler did some stunning work showing that individual cells, and these happened to be fibroblasts he was working with, when treated in a specific way, when they were shocked, in effect, by adding serum to the medium, would actually show a cellular oscillation. So that was the first experiment which showed that essentially every cell in the body is capable of generating a circadian rhythm.
So everything from skin to liver to heart to everything.
Absolutely. And so our understanding of circadian organization has changed really quite fundamentally. What we now appreciate is that the SCN is a master pacemaker producing a signal which is coordinating multiple cellular oscillators. And you can think of the SCN as rather like the conductor of an orchestra, producing sort of a rhythmic temporal signal from which the component parts of the orchestra take a reference cue and align their biology accordingly. You know, if you shoot the conductor, destroy the SCN, they'll keep on oscillating, but they'll drift out of phase. So instead of a symphony, you'll sort of have this cacophony of rhythmicity.
And does that happen? I mean, does the SCN get compromised, or do we sometimes get out of kilter?
Yeah, I mean, the classic example of a mismatch between biological time and environmental time is jet lag. And what happens, jet lag is so ghastly, not because you're simply 5 hours shifted from London to New York time, it's because all of these different oscillators are at a slightly different phase, a slightly different timing. So the master clock is at one point in time, the liver, the kidneys, the gut, are all slightly, it's sort of a smear of biology rather than a beautifully aligned temporal structure. And of course, that's why we feel so awful.
The understanding, as you say, has been changing even in the past decade and even in the past few years. There's been some discovery about new types of cells in the eye that also might help with this. Can you just take us through that?
Well, this is something that we've been working on now for, I think, the early 90s. And we approached this with very naive questions. We just sort of were interested to know that how light actually sets the master pacemaker, and then how that regulates internal biology. And of course, the reason you get over jet lag is exposure to the local light dark cycle. Now, the way that light regulates the clock is rather odd. You need quite a bit of light, and you need that light exposure over a relatively long period of time. So light levels at which you could comfortably read by are not sufficient in us to shift the clock. So we knew there was something a bit weird about the way that light was regulating the clock. And so we started by sort of asking, well, is it the rod or cone cells within the eye? And, you know, these are the dim light vision cells and the colour vision cells in the eye that are regulating internal time. And we used mice which carried hereditary retinal disorders. And in fact, those mice were being used to try and understand human diseases such as retinitis pigmentosa. Those animals, those mice, had lost all of their rod cells and had a few cone cells left. They were visually blind using classical sort of tests, and yet we found that their ability to regulate their body clock was perfectly preserved. There was no attenuation of sensitivity whatsoever. And at that point, we began to realize there's something exciting going on here. You could be visually blind, but not clock blind.
So there's something else there.
Well, that's what we said in the early 90s. Yeah. And of course, you can imagine the vision community objected to that rather strongly. I remember at one meeting I was at, somebody stood up, halfway through the presentation, said bullshit and simply walked out. And the point was, you know, we've been studying the eye seriously for 150 years. It's perhaps one of the best explained bits of the central nervous system. And you know, the criticism was, are you seriously telling us we've missed the whole light sensing system?
Is this the typical
the
way science works? Well, people shouting at each other like this.
I mean, there are elements of that. So anyway, Those early experiments suggested that there was a difference, but actually they were flawed in the sense that we couldn't show that there was another receptor because there were those few cone cells left in those early animals. And the argument was, it's a very simple task. You just need a few pretty grim receptors left, and they can do it perfectly well. So what we had to do was then take our rodless mouse and combine it with another mouse that didn't have any cones at all and produce a genuinely rodless, coneless
mouse. Completely
blind. Completely lost its visual sense. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are theoretical arguments why the original model was perfectly good, but what we had to do was eliminate any sniff of the classical receptors in the eye. And when we did that, the responses were perfectly preserved. And we knew that it was an eye response because if you used opaque contact lenses, whereby you could block the light getting to the eye, then you blocked any effects of light on the clock. So there had to be a new receptor system. And it was wonderful. I mean, it was just such an exciting time because, you know, this was entirely unexpected. And we were really the only group working on it in the world. Since that, it sort of provided the conceptual framework for a whole, you know, lots of different groups now to start dissecting what this pathway is. We, working on the mouse, and colleagues Mark Hankins and Rob Lucas, showed that it's actually a small group of light-sensitive ganglion cells. Now, the ganglion cells are those cells within the eye that form the optic nerve and project on into the brain. And we showed that about 1 in 100 of those cells is directly light-sensitive. And it uses a novel light-sensitive molecule called melanopsin, also called OPN4. So here you have a new receptor, a new photopigment that's firing off into the brain, regulating the SCN. But those rodless, coneless mice also allowed us to identify other light responses that were being mediated by these light-sensitive ganglion cells. So, for example, we showed very early on that part of the pupil constriction is also being mediated by this novel set of cells. And we now know that sleep, levels of arousal, and a whole raft of other bits of, as it were, vegetative, non-conscious light detection is being mediated by these receptors. So this is the mouse. What about a human? Do we have the same sort of system? And it's very likely that we do. This was shown by working on a lady who had no rods and cones, and we were able to show that she had a pupil response and she could regulate her clock, and the wavelength of sensitivity, the colour at which she was responding, matched the colour response of these photosensitive ganglion cells, this melanopsin pigment.
There's something very tantalising about that colour, isn't there? I mean, this is 480 nanometers, which is blue light,
yeah.
So the colour of the sky. Now, I mean, for a layperson, there's something quite romantic about the idea that we've evolved essentially these very, very small number of cells in the eye to look out for blue sky. And, you know, everyone loves looking at blue sky. It's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
Is it as easily explained as that?
Well, it was interesting. I gave a talk just recently, and I sort of had a flippant comment, which was, if you were God, then, you know, you would actually have this receptor system peaking at 480, because that's the, you know.
It does look like design, doesn't it?
It does. And in fact, my colleague Ron Douglas stood up afterwards and said, I understand that Russell is now learning humility. He said, if he were God. thank you, Ron. but joking apart, yes, it does seem to be ideally optimized for the dominant wavelength in the light environment, particularly at twilight. Now, people say, well, hang on, you know, twilight's red. Well, it is at the horizon. But if you look at the short wavelengths are scattered preferentially. And so, in fact, the dome of the sky sees a blue enrichment. So if you wanted a twilight detector, having the peak sensitivity at 480 is about perfect.
So just to sort of simplify this, and essentially, at twilight, the light's changing. It's sort of the world is getting darker. Your body's meant to be told, right now is the time to do all these cellular processes which shouldn't be damaged by UV, and also go to sleep now. At some point soon. This switches these particular ganglion cells on or off, or at least sends the message to the brain to say, now the light's changing. And so now you need to go into the next phase of whatever it is your metabolic process you're doing.
Well, I think that's what's so exciting. We know what the receptor is, we know what the cells are, and we know we're talking to lots of different brain structures, but what's the signaling pathway? And that's what we're working on, and many other groups around the world. And what's emerging is that the signaling pathway seems to be more similar to the sort of thing you'd find in a fly eye, in an invertebrate eye, rather than in the mammals or the other vertebrates. It's a very strange signalling pathway. And so why you've got this bizarre signalling pathway, which is so completely different from the rods and cones, I think is a really interesting issue. I mean, I think if you think about the sensory task, I mean, rods and cones have to grab light in a fraction of a second and then almost forget they've seen it to produce an image of the world. Otherwise, as one turned one's head, you'd see a blur rather than a series of crisp images. But what this receptor system needs to do is gather light over a long period of time. And so it sort of counts photons. And so maybe this specialization of the signaling pathway reflects its very unique task, which is as an irradiance or brightness detector.
Now, one of the other things about the circadian rhythms is that it doesn't, that these things don't stay the same throughout our lives. People with babies know that babies wake up whenever they want. People with teenagers know that teenagers tend to not wake up at all. Grandparents tend to wake up very, very early indeed. Now, is this just a cultural thing, or is there genuinely some biology involved in determining the sort of times that different people wake up at different ages in their lives?
So sleep-wake preference, you know, whether you're a morning person, a lark, or an evening person, an owl, will depend on two important factors. One is the type of clock gene you have, and there's a condition called familial advanced sleep syndrome, and those individuals will want to go to bed by 7:30 in the evening, and they'll be waking up at 4:30 to 4 o'clock in the morning. Their whole biological clock and their sleep cycle has been advanced in time, and that's been shown to be the product of a single change, a single amino acid change in one of those clock proteins. It really is an extraordinary story whereby a single amino acid change can translate to a really very important impact upon a complex behavior, sleep-wake timing. Now, many individuals, morning types and evening types, are not as extreme as that, but subtle changes in some of those genes and their proteins are being associated with morningness and eveningness. So, in a sense, by their genetic contribution to you, your parents are still telling you roughly what time to go to bed. So that's one component. Another is that as we age, there's a tendency from the age of 10, and this is lovely work by my colleague Till Renneberg in Munich, there's a tendency to want to go to bed later and later and later. And in males, the most delayed is around about 21. And then after around about 21, there's a tendency to go to sort of bed slightly earlier and earlier and earlier. Women, again, the same trajectory, but at 19, they start to turn. They never get as late as the males. And ultimately, men and women are getting up and going to bed at about the same time when they're 55. So there are sex differences and age differences. Question is, what is it? And we don't have really good data, but the assumption is that it's the hormonal changes going on over development, particularly the steroidal changes, things like estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone that are driving these changes in sleep-wake timing. And we know that if you give sort of an injection of a steroid hormone to a mouse, for example, you'll change its alignment to the light-dark cycle. So there's good circumstantial evidence to suggest that it really is these changing hormone levels over our life, which is changing our phasing, our alignment to the light-dark cycle.
And what about modern life itself? People stay up all night sometimes, that people do shifts work where they spend all their waking hours during the night. We have bright lights everywhere. Does this affect our sort of ability to sleep properly?
Well, with an increasingly 24/7 society, you know, the first victim is frequently sleep. There's this sort of tendency to really simply ignore sleep. And if we pause for a moment and just think about sleep, you know, why do we bother to sleep? And of course, that's a big fundamental question. And some lovely data has emerged over the past decade showing how important sleep is to our ability to come up with novel solutions to complex tasks. So Jan Born in Lübeck in Germany did an experiment whereby he had several groups of individuals, and he had devised a task which could be performed iteratively, you know, A to B, B to C, and all the rest of it. Or you could say, hang on, I understand this, and he called it gaining insight. So he introduced the task to individuals in the morning. One group performed it that afternoon. Another group introduced in the morning, another, and they performed it the following morning with no sleep. Third group introduced in the morning, performed the following morning, but with sleep. Those that performed it in the afternoon, about 10 to 20% of the group gained insight. Same for the people that performed it the following morning with no sleep. So he controlled nicely there for fatigue. The group that had sleep, 60 to 70% gained insight. Got a beautiful description of how sleep will enhance our ability to come up with novel solutions to complex tasks.
So the idea of sleeping on something actually does work.
It does, yes, absolutely. And there are lots of historical examples and, you know, lots of anecdotes I think we'd probably all experience. We've woken up after, you know, struggling with a particular problem and we've actually clarified it. So that's one of the really important areas of sleep. But the other really interesting thing to explore is that for a night shift worker, What I think is extraordinary is you can be on the night shift for 20 years, but the body clock does not adapt to the demands of working at night. And so the question I'm going to ask you is, why don't you think the body clock adapts?
Because there's so much light around.
Well, sort of. I mean, essentially, you're locked onto the same light-dark cycle as the day shift. And what's really important to appreciate is that the clock will always defer to the brighter light signal as being day. So you're working in the factory, probably 300-400 lux. Shortly after dawn, natural light levels are some 50 to 100 times brighter than average office lighting conditions. And by noon, they're 500 to 1,000 times brighter. So we're actually living our lives in dim, dark caves. So what will happen is you'll do the night shift. You'll be exhausted, but then you'll be exposed to natural light during the day, and the clock keeps you locked on to the local light-dark cycle. And despite the fact that you're really tired, the body clock is saying, hang on, it's daytime, you should be awake. So you get really reduced and shortened sleep on the night shift. Now, if you take night shift workers, and researchers at Harvard did this, increase the light in the factory to a couple of thousand lux, and then hide them from natural light during the day, then they will eventually shift. But of course, it's pretty impractical. You know, you can't hide people from natural light during the day. So the night shift worker has a real problem. They're working against internal time. And how do we do it? How do we cognitively override the need to go to sleep and yet need to perform? And it's thought, but again, the data isn't really great, that we're activating the stress axis. And activation of the stress axis will override the clock saying now is the appropriate time to be asleep. Now, short, acute activation of stress is very good, you know, the fight or flight response. But for sustained activation, you run into some problems. And that constant activation of the stress axis has been associated with immune suppression. Some very good studies now from Danish night shift workers, Danish nurses, has shown that their rates of colorectal cancer and breast cancer are significantly higher than their day work counterparts. Again, the exact mechanism isn't clear, but one really strong candidate is activation of the stress axis, reduced immunity, and therefore greater vulnerability to diseases such as cancer.
And does this affect people beyond those who work at night? For the rest of us, the fact that we are... you know, more stressed in work, and there are probably we stay in the office longer sometimes, or we stay out later at night.
Well, absolutely, and some really very nice data emerging from the University of Chicago has looked at reduced and disrupted sleep on the metabolic axis. And Ev Van Kouter did a glorious experiment whereby she took healthy young males, allowed one group to sleep only 4 hours a night and another group up to 10 hours if they wanted it. And she looked at the end of only 7 days at the hormone ghrelin. Now, ghrelin is sort of the hunger hormone. And she found that ghrelin levels were up by 28% after only 7 days in that group. The satiation hormone leptin had fallen by 17%. Carbohydrate consumption had gone up by 35 to 40%. And their ability to sort of clear glucose from the bloodstream was bordering on the diabetic. So after only 7 days of sleep restriction, and 4 hours is not uncommon in many groups, there were a clear impact on metabolism. And it's those sorts of experiments which are being used to explain, for example, the high incidence of diabetes 2 in night shift workers, and the fact that more obese people tend to have shortened and reduced sleep.
Final question. Given that you know all this, you're a professor of circadian rhythms at Oxford University. Do you get enough sleep?
No. But I suppose at least I know what I'm doing to myself.
At least you know what you're doing
to
yourself.
At least I know. But I do try. I am aware that I now at the age of 51, I cannot continue to punish my physiology by staying up all night and working on a particular paper or doing long-term experiments and all the rest of it. So I am being better behaved, but I'm still a bit naughty.
Surely knowing all this makes you even more sleepless, and you can't get to sleep. You're thinking, go to sleep.
Oh God, I never thought of that. Now that's another reason to keep me awake.
Russell Foster, thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Thanks there to Russell Foster, a professor of neuroscience at Oxford University. To read more on his thoughts on circadian rhythms, you can go to our website, guardian.co.uk/science, where you can find a blog post all about his work. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. So from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, goodbye and sweet dreams.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.